If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. We've heard a lot for years now about the top 1%. But what about the next 19%, the full 20, the American upper middle class? Average income, $200,000. My guest today, Richard Reeves, says they are digging in, becoming an almost hereditary class, and leaving the rest behind. This hour On Point, American wealth, class, and the 20%. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Are we still a classless society? Really? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from San Francisco is Richard Reeves, Senior Fellow in Economic Studies, co-director of the Center on Children and Families at the Brookings Institute. He's the author of the new book, Dream Hoarders: How the American Upper Middle Class is Leaving Everyone in the Dust, Why That's a Problem, and What to Do About It. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Richard Reeves, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
The favored fifth. What's happening?
They're pulling away from everybody else. The inequality problem reaches much further down than just the top 1%, as you said in your introduction. If you're looking for kind of where's the break point, where do we start to see a group pulling away economically and in other ways too, it is roughly about that 20% point. And so whilst there's been no real increase in inequality in the bottom 80% and actually quite limited income growth for the last 30 years, in that top 20%, we've seen much healthier income growth and a pulling away from everybody else. It's true that the closer you get to the top, the more you see that pull. It's like if you think about the income distribution as like a stretchy band or something, it stretches more as you get towards the top, but it begins to stretch quite strongly at about that 80% point. And so what I see economically, socially, culturally, educationally, occupationally, is a group who are separating from the rest of society to a large degree and perpetuating their status over generations. And that starts to look like a class. When you see a group that's operating separately, that has its own sort of control of different institutions, etc., and is passing on its status to the next generation, that starts to look like a social class to me.
You're an American citizen by choice, Richard Reeves, a British by birth, which means you know something by upbringing about class. And you had a certain understanding of America, the United States, when it came to class, looking at it from across the pond. What did you grow up thinking or come into adulthood thinking about how Americans handled class compared to the British? And what did you find when you really moved in and settled in here?
So I grew up in a nation that's saturated in class consciousness, where every conversation, every meal is constantly being calibrated for whether you said the right thing, used the right fork. My mother, when we were growing up, would threaten us with elocution lessons so that we would speak properly, and ballroom dancing lessons, which we did have. And that was because there's this fear that you're going to be held back by kind of doing something wrong, cutting the cheese in the wrong way or whatever. And I hated that. The class consciousness, it's a nation that drips with it. There's snobbery, there's inverse snobbery, but there's this constant sense of class. And so I grew up hating it. And one of the things that appeals to me about the US and why I came here and why I'm raising my two youngest sons here is, and I have an American wife, is the sense of more classlessness, that in our interactions, that there's more of a sense of equal respect, that you're not being kind of instantly judged and so on. And more of a sense of openness about the possibility of rising. Americans will put, you know, future president on the T-shirts of their children. And they're not always joking. We can't do that in a hereditary monarchy. No one says future king on their, you know, we know who the future king is. But actually, I've come to miss British class consciousness. I never thought I'd say that.
Miss it?
But here, my new... I miss it, yeah. And it sort of pains me to say that because I've hated it so much. And the reason I miss it is that not because it doesn't have all those terrifically horrible consequences, but because at least with class consciousness, you're aware of class division. At least in a nation that's kind of constantly thinking about and calibrating class, there's political space to recognize that, yes, we have class divisions, and maybe we should do something to try and reduce them. In a society like the US, you have in some ways the worst of all worlds, which is deep class divisions, but a veneer of classlessness. Under the myth of meritocracy, we're able to convince ourselves that, no, hey, this is a classless society. All my success is down to my own unique brilliance. And so there's a sort of denial about the existence of class, even as behind this veneer of classlessness, the class machine works pretty effectively here. In fact, in some ways, it works more ruthlessly efficiently than in the UK. It just does so more quietly, and that's quite dangerous.
Okay, for some portion of our listeners, this is going to be tough to take on board because you're talking about the myth of meritocracy. People may look at their own, and we should define what you're talking about in terms of dollars when it comes to this favored fifth or 20%. Mm-hmm. But you may want people listening and saying, wait a minute. Yes, I'm doing okay, but I worked my buns off for this, and I still do every day. And what do you mean? I'm just the lucky recipient of class status here. I worked hard for this, and I... you know, did well in school, and I got into that college, and I got that job, and this isn't class. This is my effort, the meritocracy path that you don't buy. Why?
Well, you're right, Richard. The group, the average income of that top 20% is about 200,000. It takes an income of about 120,000 to get into that group, and then to get into this top 1%, who I'm sure we'll get onto, is closer to 400,000. A year. So the best way to think of this group is kind of healthy six-figure incomes in terms of household income, which does put them in this top fifth of American society. It's that group that have been doing better over the last 20 or 30 years. And then you're right. I think it's crazy to say, look, there's no effort involved. People aren't working hard. People are working hard. It's not a leisure class by any means. Actually, the American upper middle class work very hard indeed. They work not only very hard in their jobs and everything else, but they also work incredibly hard raising their kids. And in their communities and so on. This is not the sort of old aristocracy by any means. And so it's important.
So then people may say, back off, Richard. We worked for this.
Right. Well, and to the extent that they did work for it, I will back off a bit, but I won't back off completely because it didn't work for all of it. And so we have to be able to hold two thoughts on our head at one time. Yep. One is that, yeah, people work hard and they do all that, but hang on a second, let's just look, right? Let's look at the way you became wealthier, for example. You just say it's all hard work, but we were able to buy a house using the mortgage interest deduction. We were able to kind of protect that home using zoning laws. We were able to therefore ensure your kids got high quality public education because you lived in the right neighborhood and they went on to do well. Was that all just the result of your own personal effort? No, it was partly the result of the way that the systems work. And that the position you're now in allows you to make life go better for yourself as a result of both your hard work, but then also because of some of these systems that slightly rig the contest in your favor. And it's a very hard thought. It's particularly hard in America because there is this deep sense of, look, I worked hard. And by the way, everyone will say that. The top 1% will say that. The top 0.1% will say that. It's very hard to find an American who will say, yeah, I just got lucky. And even when they say it, they don't really mean it. And it's one of the great things about America is this sense of the work ethic and wanting to strive and so on. But at the same time, taken too far, it becomes a justification for a class-based system. And it means that people do not look hard enough at the way that the education system, the housing market, etc., is working in some people's favor. And it has nothing to do with their merit. That has something to do with the system.
It's scary if you think that it's really locking out 80%. But is that borne out in the figures over time? Is the 80% not... standing with access to that 20 with the right combination of, you know, grit and hard work and all the rest?
Sure. Any of these lines are somewhat arbitrary. I think everyone has to recognize that when you do this work. It's true of the top 1% too. There's movement in and out of that. There's movement in and out of the top 20%. But the reason why I've come to believe that there's a real fracture there in society is that it's not just visible economically. It's also visible in, for example, the growing economic segregation of our neighborhoods, the increased domination of selective higher education by kids from this top 20%, increases in life expectancy, changes in health and so on. And so it's across a range of dimensions where you see these things clustering together. And you see it in family life too. You see it actually in the fact that you've got college graduates marrying college graduates. Their marriages last longer than in the past. They're less likely to get divorced than their parents. So they're very stable families. You see growing wealth gaps. So it's across, it's the fact that it's multidimensional that makes you think it's more kind of a class system. Yes, people can move in. But it is the case that the bottom 80% of the last 30 years have seen much less growth in their combined pre-tax income than the top 20% has. So the top 20% have seen a bigger increase than the bottom 80% combined. It's 4 trillion versus 3 trillion, to put the numbers on it. And so what I'm afraid of is that you get a sort of a kind of locking out mechanism whereby there comes a certain point where you've got a group of people who are pretty powerful economically. They're able to use that power to insulate themselves from lots of economic risk, separate themselves off in certain neighborhoods and certain institutions. And then here's the kicker. Because they're quite separate, I should say we, because we're quite separate, the reference point for what constitutes being rich changes because you're comparing yourself to other members of your own class. Mm-hmm. And so then you've got a really dangerous vicious circle, which is that there's a lot of people who are in the 90th percentile, $250,000 a year income, and they say, I'm not rich. You know, Mary over the road, she's rich. She's got a beach house, or so-and-so's got two cars. And so if your reference point is just members of your own class, it's easy to convince yourself that you're not doing so well. Yeah. And so my fear is that you get to a certain point of class separation where if you separate off from the bottom 80% and you only compare yourself to other people, you can very easily come to feel as if really you're only just getting by. Then you'll resist any policies that take even a tiny bit of your power away. And that's essential. We've got to raise consciousness around this if we're to have any chance of enacting policies to do anything to help the bottom 80%. Our problem, candidly, I say this from a policy think tank, right? Mm-hmm. Our problem is not a lack of policies. Our problem is a lack of a political environment in which progressive policies can actually be implemented. And I've come to believe that that's only possible if the upper middle class look in the mirror and say, hey, we're doing pretty well. We need to give up something.
Tons of implications here. When you raise this with members of the 20%, and as you say, that's probably easy because you're probably mm-hmm. surrounded by them. Do people say, yeah, you're right? Or do they say, come off it. You know, I'm paddling as fast as I can here, and if I don't keep it up, I'm in trouble. And don't tread on me.
Yes, you get that a lot. You get both reactions, of course, and it's partly this reference point issue, which is, look, you can live in, as I do, in an affluent suburb, and I can look across the street and say, well, I thought I was affluent until I saw Bob.
What a beautiful new Audi he's driving or whatever.
Yeah, and Bob has a house at the shore, and I, wow. Yeah. And that's true of everybody, right? So I think we've just got to be more reflective about those sorts of processes. It's human nature in some ways to compare ourselves with people who are around us, but we've got to be more reflective about that. But yeah, there's a strong resistance, I think, because, look, I think that where it's particularly strong, actually, is among some liberal members of the upper middle class. They're really attached to this idea of meritocracy, and they struggle with the idea that maybe there are other things in their favour too. And so that's when the dinner party conversations turn a little bit awkward.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumeraccess.org, number 3030.
There we were, Berkeley, 2011, Occupy Wall Street movement. We are the 99%, and that made it pretty easy. 1% super rich, they're the problem. All the rest of us in the other boat, and we are protesting. My guest today says it's not that simple. We're talking about not the top 1%, but the top 20%, America's upper middle class, and to charge that right behind the super rich, they are hoarding all the goodies behind rising barriers of class. Richard Reeves is with us. His new book is Dream Hoarders, How the American Upper Middle Class is Leaving Everyone Else in the Dust, Why That's a Problem, and What to Do About It. You can join us this hour. Do we have an upper middle class that's surged ahead, dug in, and now doesn't want to share, maybe doesn't even see it's a privileged class? Is it easier to complain about the top 1% because there are so relatively few of them? Do you blame people who have done pretty well for trying to hang on and make sure their kids do well too? What about the other 80%? Their dreams, their kids. Richard Reeves joins us from San Francisco. Is this really different, Richard? Is it different from what you would have seen if you took an X-ray of the American population in 1950 or 60 or 70?
Yeah, it is different. Since the late 70s, we've seen this increase in inequality at the top, where we see this kind of pulling away of the top 20%. And then within the 20%, you see a stronger pulling away at the top. That's where the top 1% bit is true. But essentially, you know, if you look at the economic a picture, a snapshot, if you like, of the income distribution in 1980 and today, the bottom 80% hasn't changed. So the gap between someone who's like 4/5 of the way up and 1/5 of the way up hasn't increased in those last 30 years. All the increases happened. All the action is above that point. All the inequality action is at the top.
You mean so the surge in income?
All the pulling away, yeah. There's mm-hmm. So the economic gaps have not increased within that bottom 80%. And as I think you said in your introduction, also there hasn't been very much income growth, as we mentioned earlier. So all the action is towards the top. And what's interesting is that this kind of we are the 99% rhetoric, which I think was one of the most unhelpful pieces of political rhetoric of recent history, has allowed people within the top 20%, people who are on, say, $250,000 a year or whatever, to say, no, I'm just an ordinary Joe. I'm just struggling like everybody else. And it's just those people at the top, you know, that lot up there pointing up and really angry at them. And that's, in a way, that's just to let yourself off the hook. It's not to say the top 1% shouldn't pay a lot more tax and there isn't a huge problem with the top 1%. There is. But that's not the end of the inequality debate. And you see from one of the Occupy demonstrations, I don't know which one it was, whether it's the one you just played, but 1/3 of the people there had earnings of over $100,000 a year. So they're out on the streets with banners, down with the 1%, we are the 99% and so on. And yet they're way into the top 20% of the income distribution.
But doesn't that at least indicate a sympathy, a fellow feeling with people in the full range of incomes in this country to be out there with that?
Well, that's one way to look at it, is to say that's what part of what they're doing. But then when you turn around to those people and say to them, okay, so actually you're doing quite well too. You may not be in the top 1%, but you're doing pretty well too. So I'm going to raise your taxes. I didn't mean me. And it's one of the big problems is that everyone's in favor of the rich paying more tax. Well, not everyone. A lot of people are in favor of the rich paying more tax.
Yeah.
But I'm not rich. And the trouble is that's true all the way up the distribution. And so there's a kind of, there's a failure, I think, to just recognize that we may well be on the winning side of the inequality debate rather than the losing side. And it turns out it's much harder to have that thought. It's much easier to point the finger either up at the top 1%. Or down at the poor, and then make inequality quite a distant problem, a problem of, you know, somewhat of other people, other places, other institutions. Whereas I think inequality is quite an intimate problem. It's quite actually about how we conduct ourselves
and you quote
in our daily lives.
You quote some really concerned about this. Robert Putnam in his book, Our Kids, talking about an incipient class apartheid, mm-hmm. apartheid in the United States. That's tough to hear. Andrew in Fredonia, New York. Andrew, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Thanks for taking my call. One of my questions is, what kind of jobs are associated with this top 20%? And are they, you know, company jobs or self-employment jobs? And then also along with that, is education one of the biggest factors as far as moving up to that 20%? And if education is a big factor in it, the current Secretary of Education is looking to break down the availability of everybody getting a quality education. And if that's the case, then this becomes more of a freedom issue because not everybody is going to have an opportunity. Only a select few would have that opportunity.
Andrew, let us pick up both of those. Mm-hmm. I mean, Richard Reeves, the first question mm-hmm. kind of there is, how the heck do they do that, that household income of $200,000? Mm-hmm. How do they do it? What are the jobs? What's the you can hear wait a minute, how do you do it?
So they're both great questions. So the answer to the first one is, it's primarily these are professions and upper management within companies. So you're sort of middle and above in terms of management. and some self-employed people. It's harder to get at the incomes of self-employed people just because they very often have negative income in a particular year. And so it's harder to get a sense of where they are. But really, if you were to describe it as a class, it's a predominantly college-educated, professional and middle to upper management group. And the professions can reach kind of pretty far down. I mean, it's not, we shouldn't have a view that this is just doctors and lawyers and so on. You know, if you're doing incredibly well as a nurse, for example, and you know, there are two nurses in a household, then actually you could be doing pretty well too. So it's not just the kind of very elite jobs, but it's mostly those. And that, I think, brings us to the second point that Andrew makes about education and the role of education. So you see this strong clustering of educational status at the top here. These are college graduates who marry college graduates and breed college graduates, to put it very bluntly. Mm. And this is at the risk of becoming even more unpopular. The education system in the US is supposed to be the great equalizer, to use that famous phrase. It actually turns out to be a pretty good stratifier. And that happens K-12, where the US is one of the only countries in the world where poor kids don't get more money spent on them than affluent kids. And the best teachers are in the public schools that are serving the most affluent Americans, like myself, or indeed in private schools. And then it really gets things turn really ugly in higher education.
I mean, when did that happen? You know, wasn't it an equalizer at one point? I mean, I grew up way down that income ladder and managed to have a good education. Was I just the lucky recipient of a moment in American history?
I don't know exactly when you're talking about, but I'm sure you're talking about sort of middle of the post-war era.
Yeah.
Okay. And so there's two things happening. One is there was massive economic growth. You know, if your economy grows at 4% a year for 25 years, which it did from 1950, then that's a pretty big rising tide that will lift a lot of boats. And so even if you're not necessarily better off in relative terms, you know, relative status, you're going to be a lot better off than your parents were. That's what economic growth will do for you. Now we're in a period of much lower economic growth. And also there was a massive expansion of education, including of higher education. You saw the GI Bill, saw the opening up of public universities and so on. So there's just a huge increase in the number of people getting an education. That's really started to level off. And also what we're seeing now is that although there's many more people going to college, the difference in the kinds of colleges people go to, the difference in their completion rates, the difference in the value of their degrees is quite remarkable. And so you'll see that if you're an upper middle class American, your kid goes to a good 4-year college. And even if they take on debt, they'll be fine. The whole college debt thing is, you know, is not a problem for the upper middle class because either they'll pay or they'll get a good job and be able to pay it back. And so what happens is that the difference between the sorts of institutions people get to after K-12, in a sense, almost solidify their position, because by the time you hit the labor market, almost all the damage is done. You know, you're very well educated if you come from the right background. If you're well educated in today's labor market, you're going to do much better. And if you had a poor K-12 education and you went to a bad community college because it was underfunded, for example, you're going to struggle in the labor market. And so by the age of 25, you know, we've pretty well determined people's trajectories through life through the way the education system works. And it's supposed to be an equalizer. If anything, it's the opposite.
And maybe a lot earlier than 25. It's hard to hear, but Richard Reeves says we are cruising into a more, calcified, fossilized, classed society in the United States. Do you buy it? 800-423-8255, Virginia in Winchester, Massachusetts. Virginia, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm a longtime listener, first-time caller.
Welcome.
Because I'm frankly infuriated by this conversation.
Okay.
Actually, while I was listening, I heard him say that college debt is not a big deal for the upper middle class.
Yep, he just
and
said
I thought,
it.
Yep. Who is this insane person to be saying these things? I live in a community that is one of the most affluent in Massachusetts.
Yep.
I'm a liberal, and I choose to live in this community because for where the jobs are, this is a community that I feel my kids are safe. I feel like there's a certain kind of lifestyle I can live. But I could also get this lifestyle in a community, let's say in South Carolina or in Texas or someplace else where there were jobs, and it would cost a lot less. A lot of what you're talking about has to do with the cost of living, number one. Number two, this notion that I don't recognize how blessed I am that I can live in a community where my kids aren't having horrible things happen to them or gunfire going off or something like that, and I don't appreciate it, is crazy. And third, you know, this is a community, for instance, that everybody, you know, it's double income, and lots and lots of people work. And so, as you pointed out, two nurses can work, and they get into your into your strata.
Yeah.
But I used to work for low, trying to develop low workforce housing in Winchester, and we were looking at people like nurses as people who needed to have help getting into the housing market here. And so, I just feel like you're just approaching this thing in a really peculiar way.
Virginia, hang on. I'm extremely glad for your call. Kind of get out of my face, Richard Reeves' response here. And let's put you and Richard in the same conversation. I mean, this is your tough audience, Richard. And
yeah.
Virginia's infuriated by your take on this, and you can hear why. What do you say?
So, first of all, thank you for the call and for your honesty. And I, in some ways, I feel I should apologize that you're infuriated, but I think it's an inevitable part of the message is that we have to have these uncomfortable conversations. You're right, Virginia, that in many places the high cost of living requires a higher income, and people choose to live in somewhere that's more expensive. And you're also right that education is hugely important, which is one of the reasons you've chosen it. And I should be really clear that nothing in my argument or my book is about blaming parents for wanting to be good parents. I have kids myself, and I'm really trying very hard to help prepare them for a successful and happy life. But I do think that the issue of, say, college and kind of college debt brings up, I think, is a good example of the problem, which is that the upper middle class who send their kids by and large to four-year, I don't know what you've done, but you know, to four-year, good four-year colleges, even if they're quite expensive, the evidence is that, yes, they may well end up with quite significant college debt, but they will also end up with well-paid jobs, and they'll be able to pay that debt back. There has been no increase in the percentage of household income going to support college debt among those who go to good four-year colleges. The problem of college debt is people who actually take on smaller levels of debt to go to poor quality colleges, very often for-profit ones, and get into real trouble. That's where the default rates are highest. That's where it's most difficult. But we don't talk about that because that's not the bit of the American society that we live in or that we're concerned about. So we might look at, God, have you seen how expensive so-and-so liberal arts college is or how expensive UVA's got? That is not where the college debt problem is because those people are going to graduate. And by and large, they're going to get good jobs. And so what happens then, I use this example in the book, is if we're serious about, and you've talked about affordable housing, you're right to say that the definition of affordability changes in different places. And one of the reasons it's so hard to get affordable housing is of how expensive land is in some of the most prosperous areas. And that's because of the over-regulation and the use of zoning for single-family dwellings and the resistance of even liberal upper-middle-class people to more mixed-use residences.
Which can get very fierce in a hurry, that resistance.
Yeah, I know, but let's I think these are touchy subjects, but it's precisely why people won't talk about them. But if we don't talk about them, then we are going to drift, as you said, Tom, into a classless society. There are massive tax breaks in the forms of things like 529 plans, which I opened my book with, which go to upper-middle-class families to help them save for college.
This is the tax-free saving for college savings.
Yeah, it's a Bush-era tax cut, but it was actually Nancy Pelosi and Chris Van Hollen and other people who really killed it when Obama tried to get rid of that, because actually the upper middle class have really come to believe this. It's a myth, frankly, that they need all this help to kind of pay for college and that there's this huge problem with debt. And so they cling to these Bush-era tax cuts with a ferocity that was one of the reasons I ended up writing the book, because I just genuinely think there's a failure to recognize what life is like for the rest of the 80%. And so you end up convincing yourself that things are really pretty tough for me. Well, they're not as tough as people pretend they are. And if we continue to believe that, we'll never have more progressive policies.
But you can hear Virginia saying, look, what do you want? You want me to give my kids a lousy education? You want them to put them in the way of gun violence? I mean, I'm just trying to live here.
Mm. And that's a really important point, which is that, look, I think anybody who has, and particularly if you're from the bottom 80%, say you're in the bottom 20%, actually the people get quite angry in the overall movement. People say, look, if I had the money, I'd be doing all those things. What's wrong with you? Stop blaming them. That's what I want to do. So it's not just the top 20% that you can upset with all of this. No, there's a big difference between being a good parent and living, as I do, in a safe neighborhood with good public schools and so on, and rigging the system in our favor. And so when we're doing things like zoning people out of our neighborhoods, resisting the integration of our schools in various ways. You just saw that in Charlotte, for example. Even Massachusetts tried to pass a bill to have more inclusionary zoning. It died. in the last session. And so even quite liberal places, the idea that we're actually going to change the status quo around housing, around education, around taxes. Try getting rid of the $70 billion tax mortgage interest deduction, which is just a handout to the upper middle class. You see, you meet fierce resistance. And so I'm interested in that resistance. And I think the resistance does, it does rely on this sense of, look, I'm working really hard. I'm doing everything right. Leave me alone. But I think unless we kind of have that difficult conversation, then we're not going to make very much progress of all these other things that people say that they want. It requires us to sort of recognize that we're perhaps not as badly off as we think we are in order to give up some of that. So I'm not saying any parent who treats their own child as a social policy intervention has something wrong with them, in my view. That's not what I'm asking for. What I'm saying is, okay, so how did you react when they integrated your schools? How did you react when they put more affordable housing in your backyard? Are you going to use legacy preferences when your kids go to college? Did you help to get an internship sorted out for someone who you happen to know because you met them on your road, et cetera, et cetera? Those are sorts of questions which are harder to answer.
Virginia, are you persuaded?
Oh, I am just the opposite. I almost hung up. I'll just say two things, and then, because obviously this is the angle of your book, I think you're crazy. And I guess, first of all, I'm the mother of an 18-year-old who just finished applying for college. And so I have just looked at all the colleges throughout the country. I think you have a really skewed idea of what types of colleges are available for people. Sure, there are going to be areas, pockets in this country, let's say in the Northeast, maybe on the West Coast, there's going to be pockets in this country where there are going to be very, very expensive colleges that are very, very elite, that don't give out merit aid, things like that. But the vast majority of colleges, you can find opportunities for people. And my son, for instance, we told him we weren't going to pay for his college. He was going to have to figure out how to pay for it himself.
Virginia, we've got it. We're right up against the clock, and I apologize for that. I'm very glad that you've called. Richard Reeves, tough audience. We'll hear more from that and other perspectives. The new book is Dream Hoarders, How the American Upper Middle Class is Leaving Everyone Else in the Dust. Do you buy it? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking to Sarbat, not the top 1%, but the top 20%. A little steakhouse happiness there. Pricey steakhouse. Plenty of Americans able to roll in there and pay the tab. Probably in the top 20% of this country's income. My guest today, Richard Reeves, says their incomes, their wealth has exploded in recent decades. The bottom 80% has not. And he says there's a kind of hoarding effect. He's written that beneath a veneer of classlessness, the American class reproduction machine operates with ruthless efficiency for those in it and passing it along to children coming along behind. Do you buy it? This thesis that the new upper middle class is more locked in? And what's it going to take to keep the dream, the real chance at advancement, open to the mass of Americans? Richard Reeves' book is Dream Hoarders, How the American Upper Middle Class is Leaving Everyone Else in the Dust, Why That is a Problem, and What to Do About It. 800-423-TALK. He joins us from San Francisco. Lots of response online here. Maureen says, she says, all I know is the recession stole my prospects just as I was getting started. I'm pretty bitter about it. Everyone looks greedy, especially people who feel they pay too much tax while taking vacations and owning more than one property. Holly says, see upper middle class in small, rural, largely impoverished town, private golf and country club, exotic vacations, and resistance to progress. But Alchemist writes to us, I'm top 5%, pay plenty of taxes, give generously to charities, and volunteer free time helping the underserved. And now I'm being judged? Ouch, that hurts. Nikki in East Troy, Wisconsin, you're on the air with Richard Reeves. What do you think?
Hi, Tom. I read a lot, and I am a huge conspiracy theory. I try to keep an open mind and viewpoint, but this is a topic that really does infuriate me because, as a previous caller, state education plays a role, tax cuts, that upper 20%, that 1%. In my opinion, I do feel very selfish. It's like once you get in there, there's no way to get out, I guess. And it's like the 80% of us at the bottom, we can never get there. We don't have enough money. It seems like they are getting the breaks and we are getting, the poop end of it. We're constantly paying more out of pocket. We have to deal with other issues that they don't even know about. They don't even care about, it seems, especially when it comes to education. You know, we might want to get a better education, but we can't afford it because we're paying too much for health care. We're paying, you know, this for our car note or this for our credit cards. But it seems like they don't even have to deal with any of that. It really sucks, too, because it seems like if you are a part of that elite group, that small group, that is only you, and you are, you know, to be only with another person of your same stature. And so as a lower 80%, you can never get up to that 20% because it seems like every time you try to, you can never catch a break. And it really sucks because we see a president involved in it and other families like them and the Rothschilds as well. So it just really... it hurts because I am a single person and I'm struggling. I know married couples who don't have kids that are struggling, married couples with kids that are struggling. It doesn't matter what social status or class the lower 80% is in, because all of us are in the same boat, essentially.
Nikki, are you resentful about it? Are you resentful about these circumstances, Nikki? Do you feel like those who are fortunate enough to be in that top 20% understand what's up with your life?
They don't. I feel like once you get in that 20%, you completely forget about the rest of us little people. You know, it's that saying, never forget where you come from. Well, the 20%, especially the 1%, definitely does forget where they come from. Because again, you don't really hear about them giving back or, you know, as much as they can. They give, you know, the little bit, and where they can give more and still be comfortable living their lives. It's like us, you know, everybody expects us to donate and to give to charity, but we can barely take care of ourselves while we're trying to take care of others. And you have those top 20%, that 1% that can definitely spread the wealth and still be okay to survive in their lives.
Nikki, I really appreciate your call. Richard Reeves, how do you see Nikki's take on what's going on?
Well, we don't want to have a council of despair to make it think that it's kind of impossible to rise up, Nikki, because, you know, people do still do that. But I do think you point to something quite important here, which is this sort of how an economic gap becomes an empathy gap, effectively. Because I think that it's true that for those of us who are kind of fortunate to be towards the top of the distribution, it is sometimes quite hard to understand the sort of juggles and the challenges that other people are facing. And so, for example, the trade-off between healthcare and education costs is not one that most upper middle class people face. Generally, they get their healthcare through a pretty good employer-based plan. That's the one bit of the healthcare system that works pretty well in the US, and almost everyone in the top 20% has that. And they will be saving towards college, and so they'll be able to do that. They face different trade-offs in terms of their kind of economic situation. I do think, though, that one of the ways in which this kind of inequality might sort of perpetuate itself is that I do think there are people in the top 20% who kind of look at how hard life is, and they might empathize and they might change their views as a result of that. But they might also think, crikey, I do not want to end up down there, and I do not want my kids to end up down there. And so I'm going to do everything in my power, including cheating at the margins if necessary, to protect myself and to protect my kids, and basically to put a glass floor underneath my kids to make sure they don't fall down there to be like that. They do not want their kids to be right towards the bottom of the distribution. And so they work very hard to make sure that doesn't happen. But at the same time, their support for the institutions that help those at the bottom might not be as high as you would like, because they don't think they're going to use them and they don't think their kids are going to use them. So inequality and immobility can kind of breed off each other, basically. And I do think that the way in which, for example, tax system, housing, wealth, zoning and educational opportunity kind of reinforce each other is a good example of how you do create this kind of glass ceiling for others, which glass floor for us, which is quite hard for people to break through.
Boy, you've got, it's so interesting. I mean, Nikki's saying, yeah, I live it, I feel it, but there's on social media right now just wild with opposition as well, Richard. Mm-hmm. And we've got Freethink One says, I'm switching to Alex Jones. He's more in tune with reality. Mm-hmm. And then here's Robin says, this dream hoarder concept seems to state that if you help your kids to get ahead, you're screwing over some less fortunate kid. Well, there are some zero-sum games in life, Robin writes mm-hmm. to us. She writes, she brings me into this. She says, if Tom Ashbrook keeps his host job, some struggling, lower-income, minority, trans, antifa, this is just Robin writing, won't get to be host, so should Tom quit? This guest should not write any more books because it gives him excessive class and privilege. What do you want is kind of the message there, Richard.
Yeah. Oh, I think it's well, first of all, we've touched the nerve. Tom, I'm very sorry if this in any way threatens your own job security.
Oh, gosh, I don't know what. But.
I'm safe, but I don't know if I've just thrown you under the bus. But these are very important points. And one of the things I really struggle with in trying to make this argument is to make this distinction between, look, wanting to do the best for yourself and for your kids, and either supporting policies that are unfair in and of themselves, or engaging in practices which are unfair, kind of hoarding opportunities, right? So, and let's make some of those decisions. Let's leave some kind of examples, right, from real life, just to try and give this a bit more, you know, specifics, right? Let's take someone who practices with their kid to play baseball, and as a result of practicing every day, their kid gets onto the baseball team, right, because they've gotten better because they practiced with their parent.
Yeah.
Everyone would probably think, great, good parenting, good team, etc. And then you get somebody else who bribes the coach, who gives the coach $200 and says, will you put my kid on the team? The kid gets on the team. Everybody would be horrified by that, right? Even though the second one's legal too. There's no law against bribing a little league coach.
Yeah, so, wait a minute. I can hear people saying, wait a minute, I'm not bribing the coach. I help my kid with his college application or her college application, but you call that bribing the coach, Richard?
That's the difference. This is not about doing that. But if you went to that college, did you suggest that your kid put down that they're a legacy?
Legacy meaning because that their parent went to that college.
That their parent went to that college, because if you did that, that's a different thing. Or maybe you were a big donor to that college. You had the money to be a regular donor and you're an alumni and they put that on there too. And we know that people whose parents went there are twice as likely to get into some of these colleges. That's racist in its implications.
You're talking about like Ivy League, essentially elite Ivy League colleges.
Yeah, but some publics do it too. And actually, it's just one of those things. It's just an extraordinary thing to someone who comes to America. There is no other country in the world.
Not even your country of origin, the UK, like Oxford and Cambridge, they don't have legacy stuff?
No, it was wiped out in the middle of the 20th century. And I would just, as a data point, the royal family don't get to go to Oxford and Cambridge in the UK because they didn't get the grades. So we may have a hereditary monarchy, but we don't have a hereditary higher education system.
You say British politicians, for example, could not dream of not sending their kids to what we call public schools,
right,
whereas American politicians are at the highest, most prominent levels, Barack Obama included, certainly do.
That's right. And again, look, what I'm pointing to there is not the decision to send your kid. There's nothing wrong with choosing if you have the money to send your kid to a private school, although it does mean you're going to have to work even harder to help the other kids whose parents can't afford that to kind of stay in the game. But it's more just that there's no sort of moral angst about that. And as I said in some of my writing, at least posh people in Britain have the decency to feel guilty. People who don't want to feel guilty, and you're getting that in the responses here too. But if you're doing things like voting against more affordable housing in your neighborhood, you're opposing more integrated schools, you're using legacy preferences, and maybe, Tom, if you got an internship for the daughter of a friend of yours from the golf club,
yeah,
and they got an internship at NPR, then I'd be having to go at you because I said, look, you can't. That's exactly zero sum thing. There are only so many internships available, and so the way in which those sorts of practices work out, I think we've just got to be very careful about whether or not that's not just helping your kids do better. That's using your powerful position to rig the market in their favor and in others' favor. That's the difference. We want parents to do well, but we don't want anti-competitive behavior.
I don't golf, no clubs, and that's not the way we do internships. But I was pretty sure
that was the case.
Yeah, but I should say you're very clear for yourself. I mean, this your top 20% starts at around a household income around $112,000.
120 now, but
120. Probably. Okay, and you're very clear. I mean, you're in there. 120. I'm in there. So this is not finger pointing at somebody else. This is a lot of people who may be listening now that you're talking to, and you're very much including yourself. I'm at that level myself.
Yeah, I use we a lot in there because I'm trying not to sort of, to use a horrible verb, otherize the problem of inequality. Because I think one of the real problems of the debate about inequality in America has been that it's about looking over there or looking over there and never looking at ourselves. And so, yeah, I'm very anxious to say, look, and also to say that these are morally complex situations. And you have a situation where, look, if everyone's doing something that helps their kids, why shouldn't I do it too? And it feels like a terrible thing to do anything, even at the margins, which won't help your kids, be that an internship or whatever, or playing the legacy card or the donor card to get them into a better college than they would otherwise have gotten into. These are troublesome moral choices, and I accept that they're complex. But actually, unless we confront the complexity of them and examine them and argue about them, as we are now, then they'll just continue to sort of drift on without anybody even questioning them. And if it turns out, as a result of this debate, that there's a fantastically strong fairness argument for legacy preferences, for example, well, okay, persuade me. I haven't heard one yet. So far, it seems to me as if the arguments for these things are basically either, A, I'm desperate. Well, perhaps you're not as desperate as you think you are. And B, everyone's doing it. And to say that everyone's doing it is, frankly, the moral reasoning of a sixth grader. That's not a good enough reason for us to continue to do things just because everyone else is doing it. My kid comes home from school and says, well, I cheated in math, but everyone was. Is that okay? Do I say yes?
Let me get another call here. Donna, Eagle Lake, Maine. Donna, thank you for calling. You're on the air with Richard Reeves.
Hi, thanks, Tom.
Yeah.
I absolutely agree. I cannot argue with the statement that the 20% manages to stay the 20% by using practices they've manipulated themselves into a comfortable position. I've always wished to be in the 20%, and for a short time I was. Now I'm a laid-off factory worker, but I was the first of my family to ever graduate from college.
Yeah.
I graduated from a technical college.
Yep.
And I said, oh, well, I was determined my son was going to be a college graduate no matter what. And he is, thank goodness. But financially, he's no better off than I was at the same age. So I agree there is some argument about cost of living, et cetera, et cetera. But in the end, you know, I still don't believe he's going to ever break into that tier of quote-unquote professional.
Or the 20%. It's hard to hear that in this country. They're the caller from Maine. But, Don, I appreciate your calling. Richard Reeves, our time begins to grow short here. How to fix this, and what's the danger if we don't?
Well, I think that Donna's story points us to one direction which we could fix this, which is to actually loosen up the labor market by loosening up the housing market. One of the reasons why people like her son, who have a four-year college degree, might not be able to succeed is because many of the opportunities are clustered in particular cities which are expensive. And so we see increasingly that the parents of college graduates are helping them with their housing costs to go and live somewhere where there are jobs, or indeed help them do an unpaid internship, which is hard to do unless you've got parents that will support you, which will get them a job and so on. So actually just doing something about loosening up kind of zoning, making sure that we're allocating kind of internships more fairly. But the broader question is that I think there are two broad buckets of things. One is we've got to be doing more to help those who are in the bottom 80% to have more access to skills and education. So that's radical reform of K-12 education, for example, and radical reform of higher education. We spend a lot of money in higher education on people who don't actually need as much help. And say the community college sector, so Donna went to a technical college, needs massive investment. So it's all skewed. The way that we subsidize upper middle class education through four-year colleges, especially selectives, is really unconscionable, as well as changing some of these other practices that wipe out legacy preferences. Some of these things are just unconscionable. And then there are these kind of, that, I guess that brings me to the second group, which is like the hoarding mechanisms, right? The way that we use the tax code to reinforce our housing wealth. There's a reason there's a wealth gap. Housing is the main source of wealth, but $70 billion a year into a mortgage interest deduction, the majority of which goes to the upper middle class. Then we add zoning to protect our house values. Then we add education into that. And so moving away from this kind of very tight regulation. We used to zone out people of different color and different race. Now we're zoning out people of a different class. And the segregation of neighborhoods is actually increasing. And that clusters all these goods together. The sorts of neighborhoods we talk about at the beginning, the quality of housing. And guess what? You know, actually upper middle class housing wealth didn't drop that much in the recession. Didn't do well, but it didn't crash either. And so you're seeing almost every step the way that this system works. And so we've got to increase access to healthcare, including family planning, more early years education, K-12 reform, higher education reform, and then let's get rid of these hoarding mechanisms. So let's open up internships and workplace opportunities, get rid of legacy preferences, and let's start to zone our cities in a way that are much more open. Even somewhere like Los Angeles, it was zoned for 10 million 40 years ago, now 4.5, which is however many people live there. And that's actually where the rubber hits the road, because those are our neighborhoods, our schools, and our colleges. But if we're going to open up our hearts, we've got to open up our neighborhoods and our schools and our communities as well. And that's the only way we're going to share the American dream again.
Sounds like it could be a political third rail for some, an opportunity perhaps at the same time. And a question for Americans. What kind of country do we want to be? Richard Reeves raises it pretty starkly in his new book, Dream Hoarders, how the American upper middle class is leaving everyone else in the dust, why that is a problem, and what to do about it. Richard Reeves, thank you very much for being with us today. Really great speaking with you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you to the questioners and to you, Tom. Mm.
Listeners, thanks for all your input on the air and online. As always, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.